14th, sorry, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on a few projects and also been working on preparing online classes. So both have kept me busy, but making small progress. So next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi. I have to find the right button. I'm sitting here working on a little C utility to more thoroughly use the features of the magnetometer board. It's been a long time since I wrote a kind of a complete little command line utility in C. So I'm fumbling around a little. Good to see you all.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Dev. And go ahead, Dev.
Hello, I expect this is me. I'm Dev Joshi. I'm joining this group for the first time. I'll be joining Scranton University.
Well, fine business.
To learn from this group and to see how it goes here.
Very good. Welcome to the group. And
thank you so much.
Next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel W2NAF. Sorry, Nathaniel.
That's okay, Dave. Thank you very much. Things are going fine over here. Let's see, you just had an Easter weekend, which was very nice here. And then I'll be starting classes again this week. And as you met Dev, he's the new postdoc. We'll be working on the Tangerine SDR project. So he's joining us for the first time tonight. W2NAF, back to net.
By the way, does Dev have a call sign or do we have to work on him to become a ham radio operator?
We're going to have to work on him for that.
Oh, well, welcome, Dev.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm excited to get into pick those new languages.
So next on the list, we have Orville N8WQ, and he's shown as mic muted. And so then next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, Dave, can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, got a new installation of Windows 10 and TeamSpeak here, so I wasn't sure if everything was going to work. So anyway, just this week, finishing up some things, pretty busy, but I think I've got my head above water here. Next day or two is going to be full-time on Tangerine, so I hope to get some progress to report. And sorry, Nathaniel, I missed the meeting today. I had it in my head all set to go, and I just got busy and just worked right through it. Don't know what happened, but it was one of those days, you know. So that's about it. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And sorry if I've aggravated you with comments this week, but... you know, that's what makes a good project, is everybody has an opinion. Next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and everybody in the group. Not too busy in the week. Nathaniel and I had a conference call with the University of Houston students today and their professor, and discussing their desire to use perhaps something like Tangerine SDR for one of their projects. So it was a good call, and we've got a few questions we need to go off and research. Back to the net.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Well, I had one thing to do this week, and I didn't get it done. So in the next day or two, I will post some comments about... new boards on the horizon. And anyway, sorry about that. I really have a lot of extra time, probably too much extra time. So I've tried to fill it up with a number of projects, one of which is learning the Python language. And that's been taking up most of my day these days. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
User disconnected from your channel.
Well, fine business. And I think that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
I guess I'll start it off. Let's see. Yeah, Scotty, no worries about missing today's meeting today. It worked out very well, and Tom was able to address most of the questions, and he had a number of good questions. So I think with Tom there, it worked out to be a very good meeting.
Oh, very good. Does it look like they're going to be able to use the board?
Well, I think there's a strong possibility. Maybe I can let Tom fill in some of the details. It's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, Scotty, let me bring up my my notes. We were kind of going through most of the details. I can't hold down an Alt key and open a folder in Windows. I didn't know that. Hang on. Okay, now I can read my notes. They want to fly a receiver on a balloon project, and so we discussed with them, you know, kind of what it is they might need and to see how well Tangerine SDR would match. I think from a performance and feature point of view, they really like the receiver. It does, you know, they want to be able to record HF spectrum, and they'd like to do it on a small disk, you know, a small micro SD disk, or you know, one of the small thumbnail size ones. The key issues that we had with them were, you know, how much power does Tangerine SDR draw? We need to kind of know from clock and data engine and receiver and host, and also weight and size. So, you know, kind of the typical things. You got a balloon that only has a few kilograms of payload, and we need to figure out if we're too many kilograms and need to go on a diet, or if we're okay. That mostly questions like that.
So do you think we'll have to fly an Odroid with it, or we'll be able to, do you think we could make a standalone version to do what they need to do?
I think we'll need some kind of a computing device that can write to an SD card. And so, you know, that'll probably take a host computer of some kind. It doesn't necessarily have to be an Odroid.
Yeah, because the Raspberry Pi, that heatsink on that Odroid is pretty massive.
Yeah, there's, I'm not sure I wrote it down. They have, a total weight limitation of about 3 kilograms, but that's for most of the project, not including batteries. The thing we need to do is to compute power consumption per supply rail. We need a weight estimate, and we need a size estimate. And so you and I am going to have to go chase that down over the next week or two. And I've got one other question, but I'm going to do some research into the other question before we, and I think I may be able to find some information online.
User your channel.
Yeah, I've been, I got some preliminary calculations on power, just using the size of the power supply. But, you know, power is a pretty nebulous thing. You can be chasing your tail a lot to be looking for power calculations, because most places give you their maximum, and you know, especially when you get a lot of compute intensive chips like that we're going to have with an Odroid, and talking to the triport Ethernet controller, I don't know that it's going to be too easy to get like an average number without actually firing one up and measuring it.
Yeah. Well, you know, rules of thumb we used to have where you'd take all the maxes and you'd multiply it by about 0.65, like 2/3 or something. We used to do that commercially, and it wasn't perfect, but it was a good first estimate.
Are they believing that they'll get the payload back every time as well?
We didn't really discuss that. That wasn't really the key. The key was, you know, they have a limited amount of battery that they can fly and a limited weight for the battery. And so we have to make sure that the battery times the power supply efficiency that they use to derive all of our supply rails will last for the mission duration.
I did talk to him a little bit about this when I met with the group last week. And I think the chances of recovery are pretty good. To put this group into perspective, I think they're quite a bit more advanced than your typical undergraduate weather balloon project. This is a NASA-funded project. The guy has, the professor, Dr. Edgar Baring, he is a longtime friend of Jim LaBelle's, and he's been doing this for many years, and he's got about 160 balloon launches under his belt. He said that they do expect, they have a very high recovery percentage. He said they actually have helicopter time in the line budget for doing recoveries. So they're going to be launching out of Poker Flat in Alaska, I believe, or they'll be launching out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And they do have some helicopter time booked to try and recover the balloon payload.
Well, that's beyond most of our budgets.
I think this is, it's a pretty well-organized project. He has a group of 23 students. The ones I've met so far are highly motivated. He has them organized into teams that he is advising. So there's a team that's supposed to be dealing with thermal management issues. There's a team that's supposed to be dealing with, power issues. So it's a very well-organized team, I think.
I want to jump back in for a minute. Bill had to leave to reboot his modem. So let's have give Bill a chance to give his comments. Bill? User entered your
channel. Thanks very much, Dave. Yeah, I'm back. I actually had to reboot the computer. Something went wrong with the sound driver. I don't know. Anyway, I've been having a good time here the past couple of hours. There's been a wide open propagation between here and South America on VHF. So working all kinds of stations all over South America on 6 meters. But anyway, regarding this project, I spent the week getting the multi-channel capability working in the Tangerine, where I can specify the number of channels I want to collect data on, and now the simulator will output data on anywhere from 1 to 16 channels, and I can take that data and bring it up in the HDF view and see that each channel is different, because I've set it up so that each channel will create a little bit different frequency. And so I can see that that is all working. And so pretty soon, Scotty, I'm going to have a document for you that lays out in a little bit more detail a recommendation on the way the data should be laid out as far as what we send back and forth. We figured out what ports are going to be used. Now I'm going to come up with some recommendations, just a first concept on what the data should look like, so that we create the channels and then we send a channel configuration, what should be in there, so that the data engine knows what data to send back, and a list of rules that as far as what we expect the systems should be able to do with talking to each other, at least for phase one. And so I'll get you that probably later on in the week. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. Back to Ned.
Okay, now we've gotten everybody on the list, except there's a second Scotty.
Oh, yeah. Ignore the Scotty behind the curtain there. I'm trying to figure out how to set up the admins. It lists me as admin, and then it doesn't, so I don't know which one's which. User
disconnected from your channel. Well, I thought, Scotty, maybe you just had a split personality.
Yeah, this is my evil twin.
So I sent a notice to the list, but the SDR Academy, which is the German SDR radio group, has decided that they will not have a face-to-face meeting this year in Friedrichshafen, which is late June. But they are going to try a virtual meeting, so it's another venue to present SDR-related papers.
Sure, it has to fall on Field Day weekend.
It's not Field Day in Germany.
I'm not in Germany. Anyway, maybe a good diversion from making QSOs on Field Day.
And this was one of the years that initially, Phil Harmon, John Melton, and Warren Pratt were all planning to give papers this year.
Well, it'll be a good year to log in then and hear the virtual papers. Maybe we'll we'll even get some more.
Yep, and for the last couple of years, Andras, SDRHU guy who came to DCC a few years ago, is a usual presenter as well. Scotty, I have a question for you about FPGAs.
Okay, fire away.
Well, I've been reading, and there's plenty of stuff to read coming out of Intel. But is it possible that in your little bit of spare time, you could make a Max 10 Echo program so that if I send in a UDP packet, it would echo it back?
So you just want the ICMP ping, that's it?
Yeah, I want to be able to start on the programming of the programmer. And I couldn't see that there was a direct way to talk to the flash without using the FPGA, but there might be. The way we did it in OpenHPSDR is we had a bit of code in the the UDP server that would receive a signal and then write those packets to another place. But I thought this might be a simple thing we could write that would give me something to work with.
How about I add a bootloader to the IQ2?
That would work.
I want to do that anyway. And it might be something relatively easy because we already have, it'd be under protocol 1, but I think the programming for protocol 1 to 2 is pretty much the same, isn't it?
Yeah, the protocols for those two parts are the more or less the same. I mean, except for that we have, there isn't a huge change. Now, I wouldn't want to mix 1 and 2, so you could write a 1 to start with, and then we could switch over, but it's really not that hard.
Well, we already have protocol 1, an operating radio for protocol 1. So you could program it and then operate it. But I don't know how hard it would be to switch over to protocol 2 on the radio. Maybe we could try that. But I would much rather switch over to the RLCC protocol instead.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, what I mean, I also have a Hermes, Tapper Hermes, which is I can run either way. And if you want to try that, that's another option.
Yeah, I like the IQ2 myself because, of course, I have a few of them. So it's it would be nice to be able to upload data to that. And it would be even nicer to have it emulate the LCC protocol before we have a DE.
Well, yes. And don't forget, I do have a development kit for the Max 10. So if we want to try things there, too, I can... But I'm not proficient at writing the FPGA or the Verilog enough to write what I need to.
Well, as soon as the time frees up here, that was one of the things on my list to do because I think it's very important that we have the bootloader in the first version so that it makes it really easy for people to upgrade and reload new versions as they come along.
Yep. And the design looks good. It looks like everything should work fine. We'll have to do a little planning with the two sections of flash memory as opposed to one section in the Cyclone 4. So we have to make those few changes, but otherwise it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you know, I haven't looked at that. The Cyclone 5 is what we use in the IQ2. And it doesn't have that dedicated dual, two memory copies like the Max 10 has.
Right. So basically what I'm looking for is something that will at least echo. And if you put the whole bootloader in there, that's great because I have the protocol how to read it.
Because then the ICMP is just to prove that you loaded something that worked?
I didn't get what you meant there.
Well, you said you wanted it to ping, but you got to be able to download it. So if you get it to work with your programming software, then you have to prove that you actually loaded an image that does something, right?
Yeah, that's the next step. The first one was to get them talking, which shouldn't be too hard, but it's kind of like writing a bootloader or programmer. It's kind of hard to do it. You know, Dave Witten gave me the other idea. I could write a just a piece of code on my Linux box to act like it, like Bill does. And that's my other solution. But if you are willing to give me a bit of code like that, then that would make it even easier.
Well, the IQ2 out of the box will respond to pings.
Okay.
Did you want to generate pings from the box, or did you want to respond to them?
I wanted to first send something and see if I can get something back. So I'll go back and reread the IQ2 manual again. It's like I don't use it all that much, as much as I got it all working, and then I haven't used it as much as I use other radios.
Yeah, there's no real IQ2 manual. There's an HF2 manual and a TX2 manual. It's sort of a combined of the both, you know, of both of them, you know. So, but the IQ2 itself will run, will look exactly like a Hermes. So it'll run protocol 1, or if you're talking to HDSDR, it'll run an our native protocol as well.
Now, do you have to run it on the 5-volt power supply then?
No, you run on the 12-volt supply. If you want to program it, you can't just plug it into the USB because it doesn't provide enough power. So you have to supplement it with 5-volt power or 12-volt power, one or the other.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll give it a try. Hopefully, I won't fry anything.
You know, if you feed, you know, 13.8 into the 12-volt side, into the big DC connector on the side that has the has the micro SD card on it, you should be okay. And then it will respond to pings on the 192.168.1 network.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, I'll give it some try. Maybe I'll have some progress then this week, I hope.
Yeah, so then what I was going to do is just take that unit and add to the code, because we don't have it. We didn't use any of the programming IP. The IP that can actually program the flash, which would be part of the bootloader. So I don't think it'd be that hard. The hardest part is going to be segregating the two images to preserve one at all costs.
Yes. The standard OpenHPSDR one is the bootloader stored at 0, and the actual functioning code for the radio starts at 1 million.
Okay, they both go up from there, right?
Yes, we did an ad hoc to section one, but from the FPGA, they consider that all one chunk of flash memory.
So then, how do you keep from erasing the stuff that starts at 0?
If you program with Cortis, you can erase it. But the software that we wrote for OpenHPSDR never writes anything at 0. So this is the problem that we had, was people would get frustrated and they go get Cortis and stick the functioning code in at 0, which can work, but then you can't ever change it without going back and use Cortis the whole time.
Right, or they'd use Cortis to erase the entire flash, right? And then you're out of luck on the bootloader.
Yeah, and finding, for most folks that aren't part of the project, finding the bootloader and getting it in the right place is not well documented.
Yeah, we knew Phil and we could hardly figure out how to get a copy of it.
Yeah, but essentially that was the problem, and it did cause problems for some people.
Yeah, well, the whole goal of this project is to make this upgrade so trivially easy that nobody even blinks an eye at it.
Well, that's what I would like to do.
Scotty, quick question. Has Dave produced a back annotated version of the receiver schematic yet?
He hasn't renumbered it yet. No. I meant to get with him today, and the fact that he hasn't been talking to me is probably a sign that he's gotten busy all of a sudden. So I have to touch base with him and get that taken care of, because we need to get it back annotated and wrapped up and all done and ready to go. I think, isn't that the last thing we have to do?
Well, for the receiver, I just need the back annotated so I can start updating documentation. And has he laid out the DE board yet?
Not yet, but I gave him an advanced list of parts. So when he does get the DE schematic, the completed one, the read-in should be pretty easy because he's built all of the decals for the parts that we used.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, there's no hurry for the schematic. I just figured if he had a back-annotated one, I'd grab it before it's lost in the chain of emails too far back to find.
No, it is good to get them to keep on top of these things because, yeah, it is really easy to get it lost in time, so to speak.
Say, Scotty, can you give us a update on where John is on the timing board?
Okay. Maybe Tom might be able to give an update, too. We've kind of been working together on this, where I've been listening and they've been working. But we got the pin out. At least we got the pins picked of what we need to have on the connector. So we can lay them out according to what's best for the DE, and then hopefully the clock module will not be the critical part of it. But he's getting some pretty good results from the, and correct me, Tom, if I'm wrong, it's the U-blocks. It's like LEAT9F. Is that the right one?
Yeah, it's the 9 something. I don't remember if it's 9T9F, one of those. I'll have to go look it up in the notes. He's getting real good results out of that. Results that are hand post processed.
Yeah, and it's a 9T because it's the timing model that he's using, if I remember right. But the plan is to use a very, very small FPGA and a high quality crystal oscillator, and this GPS, and put these all on the clock module, and we'll have something that we can use on a separate standalone board that would be like a laboratory instrument for time nuts, or it would plug into our clock module slot and give us what we need to know. And I think, Tom, did he get all the information he needed from the scientist community on whether what we're going to be able to do is sufficiently accurate? Because I think we got really, really good time information. And we got, it's a dual frequency GPS, so we'll be able to do TEC measurements, but we won't be able to get raw IQ data out of it to do scintillation measurements.
Yeah, that's right. I think I found the email. He used the ZED-F9T dual frequency module. And yeah, the IQ, raw IQ data is not available from any of those, and it would come pretty fast and furious anyway. The advantage of the dual channel model is that the GPS is able to predict the time offset error for the next cycle. And that's because it uses a fixed oscillator in one part of the chain, and so there's a little bit of time error, meaning, you know, if he had infinite control of the edges, he could align them, but he doesn't, and so he knows how many nanoseconds are off. And based on that, the performance was quite good. Phil Erickson thought it was pretty amazing. It was sub 1 nanosecond timing error. He got that by extracting the error correction messages from the module and then taking his tick, his time interval counter device, graphing all of those measurements, and then hand applying the error messages to that data and coming up corrected data. Produced a couple of graphs, and I think he wowed everybody with that data.
So, how, when you say sub nanosecond, that's in relation to what?
It's in relation to, I think it's a cesium It's either in relation to true GPS time or in relation to some very high quality oscillator he's got. So what happens is he gets about 5 nanosecond raw errors out of the ZED module. And then he gets the message that's kind of the opposite of that. And he plotted the corrected numbers. And it's got a slight offset. And so I think that that offset, there was, I've got to go back and read the message, but it's with respect to actual GPS time.
But this is when he does average time, right? So he's, it's on his graph of Allen deviation. So it's like after, 100 seconds or 1,000 seconds, he can get that close?
Well, what he's, no, he's actually getting the correction message each and every 1 second. So what the message does is it says that the pulse per second time has an error of, plus 4 or minus 4 nanoseconds, and that the pulse per second, where the edge of the pulse per second happens in time is wrong by 4 nanoseconds or something like that. So he timestamps all of the pulse per second edges once each second with his tick counter. And then he takes the data from tick and he goes back and applies the correction messages to that and figures out, had the pulse per second been corrected for the error, then tick wouldn't have had an error. So he subtracted it from the tick and he got the actual error from GPS time. And so that's a 1 per second, where should the pulse per second have been? And after correction, it's within about like plus or minus half a nanosecond of GPS time.
Well, that doesn't really mean we can synchronize all these myriad weather stations around the globe to within a half a nanosecond, does it?
Well, what it means is that there's only a very, very small correction required for the voltage-controlled crystal oscillator module. And so rather than applying this huge buzzsaw of corrections, sometimes one way, sometimes the other way, and waiting for the millisecond, waiting for the many seconds time constant loop to smooth all that mess out and keep the oscillator on frequency, the amount of error going into that oscillator is vastly reduced. And that means he doesn't have to have the hugely long time constant to it. And therefore, he can get away with a less expensive VC voltage-controlled crystal oscillator in order to hold frequency and time precision. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. And then also, he doesn't need to have dual 16-bit D to A's to adjust the oscillator, right?
Well, he may still need some high-quality D to A to adjust the oscillator. That problem doesn't go away. But it means that the size of the error going to the oscillator is vastly reduced. And anytime you get noise out of the error, things behave themselves much better. He then looked at the Allen deviation of the resultant signal, and it drops by about an order of magnitude.
Yeah, because I wasn't really sure when he started talking about two ADCs or two DACs and a coarse one and a fine one. Was that predicated on the fact that would have needed a huge adjustment on the VCXO, and now that we don't, maybe we can get away with a little bit less range on the DAC?
Yeah, that was a conversation between John and a friend of his. John was on listening mode in that discussion. But my uptake of all of that was that due to various errors and drifts and non-linearities in real D to A's, you need something like 24 bits rather than 16 bits of resolution in the D to A converter that generates the analog control voltage for the VCXO.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be particularly fast, though, does it?
No, it doesn't have to be particularly fast, but it's got to be horrendously linear and accurate over temperature, and so otherwise some unusual effects happen. And so his friend was trying to tell him what it took to build a D to A that, even though it's only a 1 hertz update rate D to A, has to have quite remarkable performance.
Well, I was thinking about that D to A, and it was a codec, actually, that we used. Remember the AKM part that we used on Janus, I believe? That was a 24-bit, and it ran at 200 kilohertz. But it was a true 24-bit ADC D to A. I wonder if that would be the kind of thing that you could use, because that's not very expensive these days.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that part. I think it was designed for an audio output system, so it may have low frequency coupling issues or others. I don't know. There are some fairly. John's friend was trying to explain how to use inexpensive, low power, low cost converters and cascade them to be equivalent of a single high performance part.
Yeah, and my eyes kind of glaze over when they start talking in that kind of detail. Probably like everyone else's eyes glaze over when we start talking about FPGAs, right?
Yeah, very much so. Anyway, John was encouraged by his results, and Phil Erickson was pretty encouraged. I think John can meet all of the fairly demanding timing requirements, except for being able to detect scintillation with the part. But of course, the dual channel part comes at A, the cost. It's quite a bit more expensive receiver, and B, it needs a dual frequency GPS antenna, which is not a garden variety device.
Yeah, so we're talking about rolling our own dual frequency GPS antenna, where it seems to me he found one, or maybe you found it, on the uBlock site that was about $150. Is that you?
Well, yeah, the receiver, the dual channel receiver, was about $150. I think he found, I'm not sure where he found it, a dual channel antenna that was in the $100-something range, but he thought looking at it that it might be possible to build one a little bit less expensively than that. But the whole upshot is that when you add the additional cost delta of a two-channel GPS receiver and the two-channel antenna, it starts to add quite a bit to the clock module cost.
Well, I don't know. Maybe the LEA M8 that he was using before has come down in price a lot. But it seemed to me that when we started looking at that a year ago, that was over $100. So I'm not sure that the cost delta is that much difference compared to the original thought process we had of wanting a good GPS. Although the dual frequency antenna is not something that we had anticipated.
Yeah, I remember seeing cost estimates on the single GPS, the single channel version of the receiver, in the 50, 60, something price range in large volume.
Okay, so that I think that $150 is also in quantity. It's about $200 in singles. So yeah, I guess it does add a fair amount, but that's I guess that's going to have to be a call by the scientific community to decide whether we want to spend the extra money. I think that being able to do TEC with the dual channel and being able to get the clock that accurate is going to be worth it.
Yeah, there's from a science point of view, there's a lot of advantage of having the order of magnitude improvement in accuracy and stability. And, then the question will be, do we need to do two different modules, the semi-cheap and the super expensive, or do we avoid the middle? There's a whole bunch of project discussions that we can have later. The fact that his initial test results are so positive, I think, was greeted warmly by everybody on the science team.
Yeah, and hopefully that's such a good oscillator that they'll be producing lots of them and the price will come down, right?
Yeah, that or it works so well they'll increase the price.
Ew.
I'm looking at a uBlock branded multiband antenna for €56.99 right now for what it's worth.
Well, that's so that's the L1 and the L2 banded antenna.
Yes, it's L1 L2 / E5B.
Okay, well That's encouraging. That's a lot. I think that's better than some of the ones that John had found.
So for $200, we'd have a GPS and an antenna.
Well, yeah, but then there's the rest of the clock module.
Well, yeah, but you know, that's just a small FPGA, and the VCXO now these days I think is around $15. So still going to be pricey, but not as pricey as we thought at first.
Yeah, it's we'll have to see about that. Yeah. So at any rate, so that's what John's been up to as best as I can distort it in the translation.
Well, very interesting.
Yeah, I think that all sounds very positive.
Now we just have to get going and make this stuff.
That's right.
Seems like the pennies keep adding up, though.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a funny thing about projects. You know, the cost estimates seem to be biased. There's always a positive sign in front of them, and you know, I don't recall a negative sign there.
Well, you know, Tom, the RF modules are going to cost more than the data engine.
We'll see about that. Did you find a good deal on the FPGA?
Yeah, I got a smoking deal on the FPGA, that's why. The BOM cost right now is around $100 for the DE in 100 quantities. And in onesies, it's about $160 for the RF module. But we're still working on getting the quantity price of that. So I still think it's going to end up being a little more. We may be able to get it down to 120 or 125.
Okay, that's not too bad, actually. I was happy that we were able to find that dual channel A to D that seemed to have good performance at low power and reasonable cost.
Yeah, I wish I could get Analog Devices to treat us as an academic supporter and give us a smoking price on that part, because that's the single most expensive part on the board.
Yeah, it's that in some ways the part is the board.
Yeah, I mean, kind of like the Mercury board, you know, with $100 A to D on it.
Do they have academic pricing?
No, but they have, if they deem that your project is worthy and they want to really go after it marketing-wise, they can make you good deals on things.
Okay.
But you have to have more clout than we have.
Right. Because if there was a place that had academic pricing, it's possible, I don't know, at least for some of the parts, you know, maybe we could buy them. I'd have to talk to you about that.
Well, you know, let me ask around and see if maybe the university could talk to their university program providers and negotiate a price for it, for us to buy it and build it.
That is probably something we could do.
Because if you look at a lot of the development boards, and if they're trying to get into academic circles, and they deem that the project is going to help them, then it falls under their marketing auspices. And we built boards where they gave us the parts because they wanted to be designed in so bad. If we agreed to design the part in, they would give them to us. And so it makes the board a whole lot cheaper when the parts are free.
That would be really nice.
But this was a project we did for Aero, so it was a captive build. And of course, when Aero gives you the parts, you can't charge Aero for the parts on the board. So, you know, didn't really help us much, but it got lots of boards out cheap.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I always liked the thought of them giving us the parts for free and then we charge them for the BOM cost, but it doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess not. So I can tell you a little bit more about kind of my thoughts for what Dev is going to be working on, if you like.
Oh, yes, please.
So we're still working this out exactly, but the idea is, so Dev's job is to try and work up a good scientific sounding mode for the Tangerine SDR and for the Personal Space Weather Station. And so we're looking into the possibility of having him implement a form of super darn receiver mode for the Tangerine SDR.
Oh, okay. So would you need different data than just raw IQ data on our virtual receivers?
No, I think we'd, we would take the raw IQ data and then we would process that in a certain way. And that's, something we have to figure out.
Okay. But the processing will be done on the, host computer. So, one of Bill's modes would work for it.
That would be the goal. Yeah. So, Dev and I are going to start talking to the super darn people, and we have to, you know, still make sure about the feasibility of all this and make sure that this is going to go all right. But yeah, once we get that information, then we would have to coordinate with Bill in terms of actually implementing and coding it.
Yeah, well, hopefully our protocol's extensible enough that we can add the features that we need to, if we need to add anything on the FPGA side.
Yeah, hopefully not. I'm hoping that, like you said, you know, we get the FPGA set, basically set it and forget it, and then we're able to add these new sounding modes at the layer that Bill is working at. And I think that will, you know, hopefully the super darn sounding mode will be just one of many different sounding modes that we're able to implement over time.
Yeah, just give me an algorithm that I can implement in C, or give me a Fortran routine I can link to, and we'll be off to the races.
All right, you hear that, Dev?
I do.
All right, great. Yeah, so Dev, meet Bill Engelke. Bill is the one that's basically in charge of the computer coding implementation.
So did you mean like I should be doing on C or Fortran?
We'll figure that out. So Bill would like it in C or Fortran. The important thing is that we have to get the algorithm first, and whether you write it or someone else writes it, we just need to know what we're doing first, and then Bill will help us to implement it into the system.
For the personal station.
Yeah, that's right. Bill and his group is in charge of the actual software implementation.
Okay.
So when does Dev move to Pennsylvania?
Hopefully sometime this June.
If due to corona situation, it has been uncertain.
Sorry, I didn't catch that. Your audio is really low.
Due to this corona situation, it has been uncertain. So we're still looking into it.
Oh, so that's what's keeping you there. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as soon as the coronavirus situation lifts a little bit, then he can move up here to Scranton.
Well, I got tired of my slow ADSL line, so I signed up for Cox last week. So supposed to get, what am I supposed to get? 35 meg down and 5 meg up or something like that. So they sent me the do-it-yourself kit. My house has never been wired for cable because I don't generally, I have the ADSL and I don't use TV. So they say, just take your modem and connect it up to the coax. Well, there is no coax. It's up on the telephone pole outside my house. So I called the guy up or texted him or chatted with him, the technical support guys. And he says, well, I put in a service request to get it your house wired as a professional installation. And they gave him a date of December 31st, 2021.
Oh, boy. That sounds like they just kind of punted that off until pretty much as late as they could push it in the system.
Yeah, so they basically said, forget it, we're not doing it. So then what he did is he rescheduled it as a troubleshooting call, and he says he thinks he can get them to run at least a temporary drop off the pole down to the DMARC where the phone is, and I can handle it from there. If you can get me an F connector that I can reach, then we're in.
I've always wondered about some of these pieces of coax that I see running from up across the ground for months and months on end from the pole into somebody's house. And I think that's the sort of thing.
Yeah, I have to keep away from it with the lawnmower.
Well, you know, the thing is, if you hit it with the lawnmower, that will motivate them to come in and fix it correctly.
Yeah, in 2021. Because they're giving me some ridiculous service date of a year and a half out because they don't know when they're going to be able to come out. And they already told me, okay, we're not coming in your house. No service person is allowed inside any customer premises. So I told the guy, look, if I can reach the F connector, your job is done. I can handle it from there.
That will be nice to have.
I'm hoping they can run it overhead because the telephone line is overhead. This is a very, very old neighborhood. It was developed in the 1940s, so everything is overhead. And I'm hoping that they don't have any kind of mandate to run everything trenched or underground because like Bill says, it'll be a coax laying on the ground for 6 months. But, you know, that's okay. If I can get it off the ground, if I can get the coax in my hand, I could wire it up above, you know, that's not too hard. I just can't climb up the pole. It's like 35 feet up. And, you know, I look up there and I see this box hanging from the coax, from the hard line, and it's open and there's a whole bunch of wires hanging out of it. And I'm going like, you know, I don't even think I would want to touch that if I could reach it. I can just see getting up there and knocking out half the neighborhood's cable service.
If it's open, it's a good thing you're in Arizona where it doesn't rain too much.
Yeah, we just had a huge big rainstorm over the weekend, so anybody who's hooked up to that probably doesn't work anymore anyway.
Well, it's very common that those providers of various services that use copper anymore, they've just let a lot of those systems hang out to rot. I mean, around here you'll drive past the copper, the pole where the base things that are, you know, 3 feet high on the side of the road. They're just sitting open with hundreds of wires going, you know, just in a rat's nest. And how could that possibly work? Probably it doesn't.
Well, it might work for a while, especially out there where it's moist all the time.
This might be old news to other folks, but it might be of passing interest to somebody. I recently found that a Ubiquiti edge router I have has the ability to do load balancing across two inbound. It doesn't bind them, but it does load balancing across two high-speed WAN connections and then distributes it in the house, I believe. Typical Ubiquiti, you would never know that from any of their marketing information, but apparently it's well known amongst their online forum people. Makes it nice for me where I've got two lines.
That's good to know, David.
Looks like it really killed the conversation.
Well, I had thought about that. We had a guy here in our town that was doing a lot of load balancing over low bandwidth lines, and it seemed to fit both Bill and Nathaniel's problems of remote locations.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it answers that problem really. It doesn't do. It doesn't allow you to bond the two channels together. It just lets you have so you don't really get the sum of the two connections as if they were one faster connection. It just lets you, it does selective routing depending on the load on each connection. So I suppose it helps some.
There might be other solutions besides that Ubiquiti router that could do it, right?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some equipment like Ubiquiti stuff that might be able to do it. Normally, you need to be able, for things like that, you need to be able to do upstream routing with your providers, I believe. I can't remember what the protocol is that ISPs used to use to do, you know, to do bond multiple connections together, but there are protocols for all that.
Dave, this is Tom. There's a couple of approaches. The older approach, load balancing, basically does what's called a 5-tuple hash. It looks at the IP source and destination ports and addresses and the type, you know, UDP, TCP, and based upon the five fields, any flow of information will hash and pick one or the other based upon the hash of the five fields. The bonding one, which is, you know, will get a single flow to run at double the single link rate, is 802.3 AD, alpha delta, small AD, which is a protocol standard for doing that. And a lot of consumer equipment is now supporting that.
That's interesting. Something to keep an eye on. I have done it with non-standard stuff on Wi-Fi, you know, with Microtique devices and stuff, but never with using commercial providers.
Yeah, sorry, that should be 802.1 AD. Is it 1 AD or 3 AD? I forget which. You know, been out of the business 3 years and I've already forgot.
That's interesting to know, though. I'm going to keep an eye out for that. It's probably 1 AD, but I'll look.
Yeah, it's 1 AD.
The trouble is, I suppose you have to have an upstream provider that supports it as well, perhaps.
I'll correct that. Link bundling is 802.3 AD.
Really? Okay. I'll watch for that.
It's called link aggregation.
Yep, that's it. That's it, link ag. And it used to just be used in data centers and high-end enterprises, and more it's starting to show up in consumer stuff.
User disconnected from your channel.
Okay, finally got to the top of the list.
Well, Scotty, you did it just in time. We've just gone over our hour, so we're at time.
Okay, very good. Nice discussion tonight, everyone.
Very good, Scotty. Hope you clear up your other projects and get to some time so you can put, 200, 250% of your time on Tangerine.
Oh, it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. Instead of wallowing around and thinking about making changes and updating, I can actually get something done and we can sick Dave on the data engine.
That would be great.
Okay. Go ahead.
Dan, N4XW, are you still here?
User disconnected from
Roger Dodger. You missed my comment at the beginning, I guess, when you were off and then back on. But I'd still plan to put a little blurb on the reflector. I have not done that yet. I'll try to do that the next couple of days.
Okay, very good. That's it. That's all I was following up on. Thanks.